Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Molly Parkin, the grand dame of bohemian living. She made her name as a painter, designer and fashion editor, writing for Nova, Harper's Bazaar and the Sunday Times, but she became notorious for her hedonistic personal life, hanging out till the wee small hours in Soho and Chelsea with musicians and artists, and revelling in years of heavy drinking and debauchery. Her lifestyle was ruinous physically and financially, and she ended up being declared bankrupt. Above all else, at 79 years old, she is a survivor. Sober for more than two decades, she continues to create, painting or sewing every day. I haven't had a drink or a cigarette or slept with a stranger, which I did on a daily basis, for more than 21 years now, she says. Giving up the drink means I know what I am doing day and night. Is it important to you, Molly Parkin, to feel that you have lived a life that is vivid and full of colour and richness? Is that where the delight comes from for you?
I think I'm a typical product of my Welsh Valley. I've also got Romany blood, and the Celts are a nomadic race, so I have actually had 54 homes in adult years, and I have been blessed and have made it my business to surround myself with larger-than-life characters. I've learned a lot from them, especially some of those lovers. I was a painter and a writer as well. I've just written Welcome to Mollywood. I'm pleased about that at this stage in my life. It's kind of set me free, this latest memoir.
It seems curious to me as I sit here looking at it, you say you're very much a product of the Welsh Valleys. I mean, you really couldn't look any more fabulous and bohemian if you tried. You know, you'd be at home on the streets of Soho in New York or Berlin. Or, you know, no, I don't immediately place you in the Welsh Valleys.
Don't you?
No, I really don't.
You haven't
been
there on Saturday night then?
That is a very fair point. I wanted to ask you about harbouring regrets. You know, when you came in today into the studio, you had this sort of enormous and immediate smile on your face. You're very ebullient. Are you somebody who looks back at the times of your life when things were more difficult and regrets that maybe you missed out a bit or you didn't quite play it as you should have? Or do you think it's all experience, is it?
Well, when I say don't harbour regrets, my own mother was an alcoholic. My father was too, and it kind of runs throughout our family in the background. But my grandmother was my role model, so I am a sublime grandmother. I would have liked perhaps to have been, I was kind, but an alcoholic mother is not what I would wish on anybody. But those two girls of mine, Sarah and Sophie, we're so close. I've made amends, and we've come through any lingering resentments, which I'm sure would have been there. I must say that about regret.
We have so much to talk about. We also have to fit in, of course, eight discs
that
you have carefully chosen. So let's go to the first disc of today. Tell me what it is and why you've chosen it.
Accentuate the positive. That seems to have been the theme of my life, and I was encouraged to do that by my grandparents, by all my spinster aunties who'd lost would-be lovers, boyfriends during the First World War. And I believe, however low you go, there's always a little shimmer of light somewhere to concentrate on.
To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark.
Well, what did they do just when everything looked so dark?
Man, they said you gotta act sense.
Accentuate the positive.
Limb.
Money
the negative and latch on to the affirmative, and don't mess with Mr. In Between. No, don't mess with Mr. In Between.
That That was Bette Midler and Bing Crosby and Accentuate the Positive. I have to tell you, Molly Parkin, I have never felt duller in my dress. In you walked today and you're wearing... Is that an astrakhan cape? What is that made of? In a sort of raspberry colour. It's fabulous.
No, this is sort of fake fur.
It's fake fur.
Yeah, it was a cushion in Oxfam until I seized it and I took it to pieces and I've lined it with silk and I've made it into a collar.
It looks tremendous.
A huge, huge collar.
Underneath that is a sort of flowing cape in crushed red velvet.
Yeah. It's slight clashing. Whatever I put on, it's got to disturb what's there already.
And the hat, of course. Can you describe the hat to me? I don't think I'll do it justice.
The hat is bright red, pillar box red and black striped. And it's got applique on it in scarlet.
Looking at you, I'm wondering what your house looks like. What's the decoration like inside your house?
Well, think of Frida Kahlo. Her studio in Mexico, the Mexican painter.
So the walls are painted what colour?
The whole of the kitchen is scarlet lacquer. Mm. So it's very shiny. Then inside, it's a fluorescent pink. And you must remember that all my paintings are on there. And any bits of jewels or beads or whatever, I will scoop up just to put on the wall.
Now, as an artist, you obviously have a wonderful eye for colour. It's interesting you say that you deliberately slightly set things off so they're not quite matchy-matchy too much, because you want to, presumably you want to be sort of stimulated.
I wanted to stimulate the eye of anybody who looks at it, and myself, of course.
And are you sort of magpie-like, always looking for colour and stimulation?
It seems to come into my life and I can't say no.
Right.
Okay. Like all those lovers. Very difficult to say no.
Yes.
When somebody's got an expectant look.
Now, you said that colour is a little like lovers, you know, difficult to turn down, difficult to disappoint. These days, how's the situation with the lovers going? Is that
I've lost
flourishing?
All the urges.
Have you?
Yes. The hormones just dropped out of my underwear on top of my shoes. I don't know where they went, but it's gone now. And it's like being unleashed from a lunatic. I mean, Georgie Melly told me that one. We didn't think of it either ourselves. It was French surrealist who coined the phrase. And do you know what? When I was in the throes of all the hedonism, you call it debauchery. I don't call it debauchery. I think it's giving gifts. You know
right.
what I mean.
So you
and
think
a wonderful that, thing to do.
Was that an unfair word to use, do you think?
Well, it's got critical overtones, whereas hedonism is a rejoicing in life, and debauchery is as if you've gone down the wrong passage, which I never think any passage is the wrong passage.
Right.
And do you like mixing with people like that, you know, where sexual intercourse is just like shaking hands? And I was told by much older women than me, they said, Moll, you might think that this heady lifestyle of yours is where it's at now. The best is yet to come, Moll. Really? I said, how can it be better than this? And they said, right at the end, when that urge has subsided, then the true joy of life will be revealed to you. And now that is exactly where I am. So love, on a very profound level, comes unexpectedly and brilliantly.
Let's have some music. Tell me about the second disc we're going to hear today, Molly Parkin. What is it and why have you chosen it?
The second disc is Leanne Carroll and it's called Three Cheats to the Wind. But I've chosen this one because I had met Bette Midler, and I didn't go into that, but we were kindred spirits immediately when I interviewed her. Leanne Carroll is a fellow Aquarian, and Three Sheets of the Wind is, to me, in the exaltation of a drinking in the open air on top of a mountain with friends or on the seashore, and she just captures it. And I love it.
Suckle on my honey and I kiss your fingers dry. Three sheets to the wind like an orphan butterfly. Sand tree dying, shrouded in lace. Bearing big dragon like the loneliest face, yeah. So come listen to the sound when I'm dreaming. Listen to the sound when I'm dreaming. It's down here.
That was Leanne Carroll and Three Sheets to the Wind. You said, Molly Parkin, that you come from a background of teachers, preachers and miners.
That's right.
Yeah, that sounds quite strict as an upbringing. Was it strict?
Well, it was very, very religious. My grandfather was senior deacon. My mother played the organ in the chapel. Presbyterian. We went three times on Sunday and in the week as well. I mean, we were on living on the side of a mountain anyway, and God seemed very close. He was just at the top. But I did drop all that and boasted of being an atheist when I was started drinking, when I came to London. Right. I thought that would be a cynical and clever and sophisticated thing to do.
Have you come back to religion then? Do you go to church now?
I am a very spiritual person, and that happened when I gave up drink. My granny's voice came to me. She came to me and said, enough is enough.
Okay, but
God stepped in.
You felt that somebody bigger was in charge, did you? That was...
Well, I felt my granny, but she epitomised. She herself had lost 11 children. My mother was only one of 12 to survive. She was a very pious, very wonderful woman.
What had they all died as children?
Underneath the age of 5. TB or terrible things, pleurisy. It's very damp, our valley.
Right.
And also that family was a doomed family. My great-great-grandfather lost the castle. He was a boozer and a gambler. Gambling's something that I have stayed well away from.
Right. He lost the castle. Tell me more.
How did... On the turn of a card. The whole castle and the mountains, which they'd owned. These things matter very little to me, but it was very big in my childhood. And there was a very, very strong work ethic.
You were very close, particularly to your grandparents, weren't you?
Yes.
Right. What are your happiest memories, your strongest memories of times with them?
I remember we would sit in front of the fire, always in front of the fire. That formed me as a painter, really, because coals form into buildings. And then she said, look, there's the castle crashing to the ground. And then we would look up at this photograph, this awful sepia photograph of Craigenor's castle. It's still there now. I've been there since. I would sit just by her, and the serenity of this wonderful woman translated itself to me. Safe, very, very safe, you know?
Let's have some more music then, Molly Parkin. What are we going to hear next?
I think we've got Louis Armstrong and A Kiss to Build a Dream On. And why I've chosen this is when I came to London, left art school and started teaching at Elephant and Castle. And I met a Welsh jazz pianist, Dil Jones, wonderful. And he said to me, Moll, there's somebody appearing in London, a black musician. He wasn't well known at that point, Louis Armstrong. And you've got to see him, Moll. And so I did go. And at the end of it, Dil introduced me to Louis Armstrong. I was in fragments with joy, the delirium of hearing this jazz for the first time and seeing him play and the love of life which came from him. He caught hold of me and he whispered in my ear, you're mine for tonight, honey. And I drew back and I said, I can't do that. I said, I've got to teach in the morning at Elephant and Castle. I have to go back home to bed now. And he just stopped me with this wonderful Satchmo mouth and kissed me full on the lips.
Oh.
I'd never been kissed like that before. And, you know, he set all my blood boiling.
I bet he did.
In a different path. And within a fortnight, I'd lost my virginity. I said to him, I'm a virgin anyway. And that's when he kissed me. Anyway, there's something you talk about regret. So he's remained with me.
Let's hear it.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on. And my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this. A kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me. And my imagination will feed my hungry heart.
Louis Armstrong and A Kiss to Build a Dream On. There was a good bit of throaty laughter going on throughout that, Molly Park, and that was bringing back the memories, wasn't it? I've seen photographs of your mother. She was a very glamorous, very beautiful woman.
Yes.
And what was her character like?
Oh, my mother, you know, the blight of beauty, really. And also, she was thought to be the beauty of the valley, with strange navy blue eyes, like mesmerising, really, and a vivacity to go with it.
When you say the blight of beauty, what do you mean by that?
She had a big psychic burden, the death of 11 of her siblings, you know? she was the only one to live. So there was great expectation on her. With her looks, her personality, and, of course, she was a wonderful pianist. I mean, she could have been thought to be bipolar now. So my mother was in and out of psychiatric wards, really, all through our girlhood.
How aware were you of that as a child? Did you know that your mother was...
Very, very aware. Right. Very, very aware. It was very frightening as a child because she would be in the front room pounding Beethoven, pounding all sorts of very dramatic scores with the door locked, and then that left me. I don't know. Well, my sister wasn't with us for the first years of my life. My mother couldn't cope with her, and I would be there, prey to my father's attention. So my mother, she would have made an amazing concert pianist, but the nervous system wasn't there.
Let's have some more music. Much more to talk about, but for now, some music. We're on disc number four now, Molly.
We're on disc number four, and that's Ian Shaw, Welsh boy, also who I've known for many years, about 23 years, and this is called Somewhere Towards Love. When he was 14, he's now in his late 40s, he asked for his birthday present to be a copy of Molly Parkin's Good Golly Miss Molly, with me on the cover with a sequin top hat, because he said, when I grow up, I'm going to marry Molly. But we are very, very close friends. He wrote this Somewhere Towards Love, and it was about rejection in love, something I actually haven't experienced, you see, though I have rejected and broken hearts. Sorry about that. Perhaps I regret that. But anyway, when he plays it, as he does in concerts all over the place, and I'm in the audience, he dedicates it to me. He says, you know, Molly is now 117 and my girlfriend.
Some things you can hold tight in your hand. Some things unfold. Some things are planned. Sometimes beyond. Sometimes above, always for you, somewhere towards love.
That was Ian Shaw and Somewhere Towards Love. You said a moment ago, Molly Parkin, talking about your mother, that because sometimes she ended up hospitalised because of her condition, the phrase you used, I think, was you were vulnerable to your father's attentions. You did suffer severe beatings and sexual abuse at the hands of your father. For how long did that last?
That lasted from my earliest memories. But at seven, I think I was rescued from that because I developed mastoid and right. went to hospital. And then outbreak of war came in 1939. And I spent the whole of that time down with my grandparents, which saved me.
You wrote about your experiences. And since you have said, I had to offload my father. I yes. wrote it out of me and I had to have a bucket beside me and I vomited it out.
Yes, I was. I was physically... I wrote it in a friend's place in Mexico and I didn't publish it. And then I thought, but you wrote that because you would have liked to have read something like this because it would have helped you. Having published now Welcome to Mollywood, the number of emails from all over the world have come and say, your story, Molly, is my story. And if you can move beyond it, I can too.
And in terms of the impact that it had on your life for many decades after, you wrote in a poem, the poem was called Bedroom Behaviour. It begins, I used to regard violence as evidence of passion. I used to mistake jealous rage for mad love. Mm. So the legacy of your father's actions was with you for a very long time. You ended up in violent relationships.
I did end
yes.
up in not boyfriends or anything, but there was violence within both of my marriages. Now I wouldn't dream of allowing anybody to raise a finger to me. But then I fought like a cat and dog fight. I fought back. I lost teeth, broken noses, black eyes. You know, they were scratched from stern to stem. I laugh about it now, but that's not very healthy atmosphere for children to be brought up into.
No. More to come from Molly Parkin in just a moment. For now, though, some music. We're at your fifth track of the day, Molly. What are we going to hear?
This one is George Melly and Hoagie Carmichael's wonderful song. This is called Oh, Rocking Chair's Got Me. George and I did enjoy a wonderful friendship. I call it a friendship. And he asked me to go when he was dying with cancer. He said to me, let's just enjoy old times. And he opened the bedclothes. Now, he was asking me in for a cuddle. He wasn't asking me in for anything more seductive than that, just to hold him. So it was like a need for somebody that they knew very well. And so Georgie Melly and Rockin' Chair's Got Me sort of hits the spot for me.
Oh, Rockin' Chair's Got Me. My king's by my side. Go fetch me my ginseng. Oh, I'm gonna tear you high. Gonna tear you high. I can't move from this cabin.
That was George Melly and Rockin' Chair. So your life as an artist then, Molly Parkin, you were 17, I think, when you won a scholarship to Goldsmiths College of Art. And your exhibitions were being reviewed very well. You were being commissioned to paint. Your friends included people like Francis Bacon and so on. It must have been a very heady milieu at that time to be hanging around with those people who were at the forefront of the art movement in Britain.
Well, the colony, I mean, I was made a member of the Chelsea Arts Club when I was 22, and that is where I met Francis Bacon, of course, and he was my boozing companion.
Did he ever paint you?
He wanted to paint me, and I don't like sitting. I'm not a sitting still kind of person. I was more interested in getting the champagne down me,
right,
and listening to him. And we had a great repartee.
And did you find that
felt to me as if I was in the amongst the right people?
Yes.
Because it was a club for outsiders, and it's sorely missed, I have to say that.
And you were also, this was a time of extraordinary creativity for you, because as well as your art, which, as I say, was very well regarded, your exhibitions.
Yes.
You were making
the bowels of the Tate,
yes.
Tate Britain, everything. I was earning an enormous amount of money from my paintings.
You were making clothes for Bieber. You opened your own store at some point. Just the hats.
Mm.
And then did you open your own clothes shop?
I did
at one
open
point?
My own boutique off the King's Road in Chelsea.
And when did you have your own restaurant?
I had my own restaurant just after. It was all in the same time.
Right. So you were able to be very creative, be very productive, and also
huge parties, 30, me doing the cooking.
Right.
Bringing up the children.
Yes. Well, let's talk about that. When was your first marriage?
I got married when I was 25.
Right.
And I was married for something like 8 or 9 years.
Right. Was it your first marriage that your two daughters were born? Right. So where was the time to be mother? Was there time to be mother?
Well, yes, because I was a painter all the way through that marriage. So I was at home.
Right.
Bringing up the children.
Right. And the drinking as well didn't inhibit you being a mother to them?
The drinking wasn't out of control then. It was like social drinking.
Right. So when did the painting turn into writing? You wrote for Nova magazine. You then went to Harper's Bazaar. Then you moved on to the Sunday Times. You won Fashion Editor of the Year while you were at the Sunday Times. So how did you begin to write? How did you know you could write?
It was pounced upon me, the writing. When I went to Nova, I couldn't write, but you know, it was a magazine, Nova, and very, very visual. So they gave me the 12 colour pages because they could see by how I was dressed, how I approached colour. And then, of course, I got the writing bug and couldn't wait to leave to start writing novels.
And you did, in fact, write 10 comic novels throughout the 70s that were very well received. We don't have time to talk about those right now because we've got to fit the music in.
Oh, dear.
Yes, we're going. we're on our sixth disc, Molly Parkin. What's your sixth piece of music?
Sixth is Michael Jackson.
Yes.
And Billie Jean. And I had always wanted to be a Soho hostess. I wouldn't have minded, you know, rather a bawdy house, really. Many people said you'd have been good at that, Moll. But this wasn't a bawdy house. I was asked to fulfil the role of somebody who just died, who was a DJ, Tallulah, a transvestite, wonderful person. And we did it for a whole year. It was based on my Welsh club down in my Welsh valley, where all ages came. And whenever I thought it's a bit empty on this dance floor now, I would put on Michael Jackson and Billie Jean. Right from the beginning, people jump on the dance floor.
She was more like Beauty Queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one who dance on the floor and around. She said, I am the one who dance on the floor and around.
That was Michael Jackson and Billie Jean. So let's talk for a little bit then, Molly Parkin, about your years of proper drinking and sexual adventures. You contend that not, as I described them in the introduction, not debauchery, but part of a journey where you opened your mind and opened your thoughts to what was unconventional, at least.
Well, it didn't seem too unconventional amongst the people that I was moving amongst, but perhaps they were unconventional people. After all, James Robson Justice, he taught me everything.
This is a very famous actor. You had
an affair with him. Yeah, that was a two-year affair. That was a love affair. That was like the love of my life.
How old were you then?
22. I was 22.
And how old was James Robson Justice?
He was 52, so he's 30 years older.
Right. He was a terrifically well-known actor at the time that you were having an affair.
Yes, he was Sir Lancelot Spratt in Doctor in the House.
Yes. And so how did you keep things covert? Did you have to be very careful in your affair with him?
Very, very careful.
Right.
But he was very, very funny. And Georgie was very, very funny. And you know, John Mortimer was very, very funny. So we spent... And I was very funny. We had funny tales to tell each other. And humour is quite an aphrodisiac, really, if you're drinking the right wine or not the right wine. And so, anyway, it came out of control after that second marriage. I couldn't stop. I was on the Oblivion Express already.
There is a point, of course, that just before people go into recovery where they say, you know, you have to, everybody has their own bottom that they hit. When did you hit bottom and what
that
was it?
That was in the gutter outside Smithfields, having pleasured, I don't know how many of the meat porters, but I was there because the pubs open at 5 o'clock in the morning.
You say in the gutter, I mean, that you're not talking euphemistically, you were in the gutter.
I was lying in the gutter.
Right.
In the gold lamé that I'd been wearing for a week, but I had full maquillage on.
Right.
Well, it's a bit smudgy round the lips, of course. Do you know, I lay there gleefully. There is a gleeful side to drinking. Well, my drinking. And I thought, this is fun. You can't go any lower now unless you get into the, you know...
Down into the sewers.
Sewers, right, yes. But I looked around to see if there was an opening and there wasn't. I slept for 2 days and two nights. And then I woke at something like 3 in the morning and my granny's voice came to me. She said, the party's over now, Molly. You've just had your last drink, Bach. Bach being little one. And so I never looked back. And that is where I found God right away.
How long have you been sober now?
24 years. It's like, you know, three things, they depended on each other, the addictions. That was, I would take a cigarette and then I would take a drink. The two went together. And then I would look around as to which strangers to seduce.
Let's have some music, Molly Parkin.
I think we need a bit
what
of
else
music.
Can I ask? I've run out of questions. disc number 7, tell me what it is.
Number 7 is Sarah Jane Morris, a wonderful redhead temptress, a sultry singer. And she wrote this, Never Forget How to Dance. And if I've had bleak moments, like the death of my mother was very, very bleak, and friends... I never forgot how to dance. I would put on something like Michael Jackson and Billie Jean and dance.
It's been a long time coming. These feet have been confined to a basher on death row. My sentence was unkind. 21 years in a prison cell for something I didn't do. When no one in the country believes you, there is nothing you can do. But I never forgot how to dance. No, I never forgot how to dance. No, no. And if I ever got me...
That was Sarah Jane Morris and Never Forget How to Dance. So, Molly Parkin, you are known for the lifestyle you had. You know, you're known for being this person who was a sort of heroic drunk and who had many lovers and all of that stuff. Do you ever think that you have done yourself a disservice by becoming as well known for your lifestyle as you are for your talents and your productivity?
I'd been trained as a bona fide fine art. If I hadn't done that, I would have been a sculptress. That is what I would have done. But when it came to the writing of the comic erotica, even my mother said, "I'm really ashamed of you." And one auntie said, "I don't want to talk to you. The devil have written this stuff now." And all of them in the home here now were asking to read it because it's full of filth. So I already knew that I wasn't going to be admired in literary circles. I'm not interested. I'm not interested to be a person of that. You know I'm a painter, I know I'm a writer, I know I'm a poet, I move amongst these people, and to them, they know I'm that as well.
Of course, your daughters, you've said of your daughters before, two daughters as we know from your first marriage, you said, "My drunken behaviour had so humiliated my daughters." Have you repaired those relationships with your two
daughters?
You
can only... I wanted really to write a letter, but I was told, you know, at the fellowships, "No, you don't write a letter, Molly." And I said, "Well, can't I just ring them up and say I'm ever so sorry for the last 30 years? And they said, "No, that isn't good enough." And they said, "Love is not a noun, it's a verb." It's slowly, slowly catchy monkey with the forgiveness and for me to be forgiven.
I said in my introduction, above all else, Molly Parkin, you are a survivor. It is true, and it is remarkable.
I will survive the desert island.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to it.
Are you?
Oh, yes.
You'll be fine.
I've been on desert islands, and I am a loner. I have a very, very strong, big, extended family life. So it isn't that I'm starved, but I have chosen for 30 years to live on my own.
We've reached our final disc. Tell me about the final disc. What are we going to hear?
Well, this is Little Richard. This is called Good Golly Miss Molly, and he's got such life. I mean, all of these that I've chosen are full of life. They're a reflection of what I love and the sort of person that I love.
That was Little Richard and Good Golly Miss Molly. So Miss Molly, I'm going to give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. What's your book going to be to take to this island?
Well, it's difficult for me because I am a big reader, but the one that I'm awaiting, it's almost finished now, but it's a book that my own daughter, Sophie, who was introduced to the colony and all of that lot when she was 14, and she is writing the history because she knows it all and she's the appointed writer of the colony. That will remind me of all those conversations and everything that I'd be missing.
OK, so soon to be published, and
yes,
it will be yours. And a luxury too. You're allowed a luxury to make life
well,
better.
Well, if you tilt this brooch, it's by Andrew Logan, one of my dearest friends, and it's got a sparkly glass, a brilliant red around it, and it's small heart. Mm. And if you tilt it, it enlarges to fill the whole of that space.
Right.
I am very heartfelt. Can't I have one of my hats and a cloak to go with it?
No. Oh, well, you could have an entire outfit. I mean,
I'll have the outfit, and this is part of it.
Right, you can have the entire outfit that you're wearing today is your luxury to take to the island.
Oh, well, that's all right.
Right, well, there you are. Not so bad. And if you had to choose just one of the eight tracks, which one disc would you save?
Oh, that would be difficult. Have I got to say now?
Yes, you've got to say now.
Well, I think that in case I have Alzheimer's and forget who I am, if I had Little Richard, then I'd know my name was either Golly or Molly.
You may have Good Golly Miss Molly by Little Richard. Molly Parkin, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.